This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, and we move into this new year, and as we do, we're taking a moment to look back at some of the highlights of this show in the past year. And we continue our look back series today with another member of the State of Things staff who usually sits on the other side of the glass, producer Charlie Shelton Orman, with me in the studio. How does it feel to be on this side, Charlie?
It's crazy. So much clearer on this side of the glass. I can actually see you so clearly.
This is what I look like.
I know.
Are you surprised? Do I look like the guy who
I'm
you thought?
A little surprised. I thought you were a lot shorter.
You know what surprised me? We did a mic check with you. One of the things the producers do, I will tell you, is we have guests come in the studio and they work with them to, you know, to get a mic check. We want to make sure that their sound levels are in the right place and that the mic placement is good. And so every day of his life, Charlie gets in here and he says to the guest, could you tell us what you had for breakfast? And that's our way of, you know, warming them up. And then give us a few words that start with P so that we can see how you're, whether or not the mic is too close to your mouth. We had to say all that to Charlie. We said, Charlie, we need a mic check. And he was looking at me like he didn't know what to do. It's shocking, Charlie. Shocking.
I wanted to tell you what I have for breakfast. I don't know. The P words, those could wait. I had a delicious breakfast I wanted to tell you about.
All right. Well, you also have a delicious year. Worked very hard this year to produce some fine radio. Tell us what you have for us. First on your list.
First on the list is a conversation that we had this past summer with Ninth Wonder. Ninth Wonder is a hip-hop producer from the area. He's best known, I think, to a certain degree for being a part of the hip-hop group Little Brother from the early 2000s. He's also collaborated with a number of different musicians.
Including Beyonce.
Including Beyonce, Jay-Z. The list goes forever. He's got a great resume. But he's also, you know, a hip-hop historian, kind of this side endeavor of his. So we had him on the show this past summer to talk about the history of hip-hop. Hip-hop being such a nuanced and creative art form. And we looked back to the beginnings, when it started in the mid-60s in the Bronx and how it sort of blossomed from there. And it was just great to hear someone who's so entrenched in hip hop like Ninth Wonder sort of outlining the history of this art form. And what I love about this whole segment and just about what we're able to do on the show is that we're able to let so much of it breathe in the sense of we're able to hear the original songs on a lot of these hip hop tracks and then look at how it's sampled in hip hop. Just making these connections in this space with Ninth Wonder was really great. So this clip that we'll hear with Ninth Wonder, he's starting to talk about how hip hop starts to grow after its sort of its quote birth in the 1960s in the Bronx, how it grows commercially and geographically, and then also in this clip we do what I referenced, listening to a song called Ashley's Roach Clip, which was very seminal in a lot of hip hop samples, and then we play later on in the clip, we play a sample of the song Paid in Full by Eric B. and Rakim, which samples that previous song, just making these connections with Ninth sort of narrating it. It's really special.
Here it is, part of our conversation with Ninth Wonder.
You know, it was a long way between 1965 and 1979, 1980, when rap started to make its face on radio. You know, it was just something that you did in the neighborhood. It wasn't even called hip-hop yet. It was just called, you know, and talking to Crazy Legs, which is probably the most well-renowned b-boy in the world. You know, talking to him, he said, you know, we didn't call it hip-hop. We just called it something that, you know, you rhyme, oh, I rhyme, let's battle. That's what it was. You know, it was kind of a martial arts thing, if you will, right? So, but at the same time, you know, it still didn't get to the airwaves until like the early 80s. And that's being TV or radio.
But it became a real culture. I mean, these rhyme contests then drew an audience, and they became more and more elaborate, included dancing and music along with it, right?
Right. You know, that was the international appeal of it, which made, you know, the likes of Afrika Bambaataa and people like that, you know, go overseas to get with groups called, like, with Kraftwerk and find different sounds, and it just became this worldwide phenomenon overnight, like in the trenches.
Tell us about the breaks and then when sampling became possible.
You know, sampling became possible because, you know, New York public school systems in the 70s decided to cut back on arts programming and, you know, taking away things from people. Like I said, you started to create things. So people would take records to find the best part of a song, which is called the break. And sometimes repeat it. Sometimes the break wasn't long enough. Sometimes the break was 5 seconds. Sometimes the break was 10 seconds. Take two records and put them together and keep repeating it back and forth. That was kind of the precursor of sampling, but sampling has always been a part of American culture, whether it be music or literature. Some books sampled other books.
Yeah.
So, you know, it just so happens that now the sampling was on records in the neighborhoods.
Shakespeare rarely wrote an original story.
Rarely.
those are stories everybody knew. And
right.
He just kind of redid it, and that's what made him great is his interpretation of that. And his
exactly.
audience was also key. He had a live audience of maybe 2,000 people a week. There's a lot of interplay between that kind of sampling. So
that's right.
It has a long history in many, many cultures. I want to play a clip now of Ashley's Roach clip, right? This is the Soul Searchers in 1974. I want to see where this fits.
Right.
There's a clip of the 1974 song Ashley's Roach Clip by the Soul Searchers, and my guest is Durham-based music producer Ninth Wonder. So what's going on there?
Man, to be honest, there's three samples in that song. You know, some people listening to it will say, oh, that's Eric B. and Rakim Payton in full. But it's also LL Cool J's Jack the Ripper, and it's also Run's House by Run DMC. Like, there's three, and there were three back-to-back. But those particular moments and songs is where dancers would come out and dance, and that's where break dancing came from, because they would dance with these short intermediate parts and songs. So, yeah, that's kind of like the genesis of what we do.
And it's interesting because at that moment in history, in the 70s, it's done mechanically, right? We're not talking about electronic sampling, or was it?
Right. It was done by hand. It
yeah.
was done by DJs. We're going to play the break with my right hand, and then we're going to come right behind it with my left hand with the same record. And just keep it going and going and going and going until some bright guy came along. Like, let's make some type of technology that we can just loop this stuff,
yeah.
you know. And his name was Roger Lynn.
But that also, I mean, that's part of the theater of it as well. I mean, watching this happen and knowing where these breaks come, being able to actually manipulate the machines, and it all becomes part of the larger culture. So let's play a clip now. You mentioned Eric B. and Rakim's Now, this is the 1987 song, right? And I don't think that was sampled in the song we just heard, because we're about to play a clip from Paid in Full.
Paid in Full.
All right, let's listen.
Thinking of a master plan. This ain't nothing but sweat inside my hands. So I dig into my pocket, all my money spent. So I get deeper, but still coming up with lint. So I start my mission, leave my residence. Thinking how could I get some dead presidents? I need money. I used to be a stick-up kid. So I think of all the devious things I did. I used to roll up. This is a hole-up. Ain't nothing funny. Stop smiling. You still don't nothing move but the money. But now I learn to earn cause I'm righteous. I feel great, so maybe I might just search for a 9-to-5. If I strive, then maybe I'll stay alive. So I walk up the street, whistling this, feeling out of place, cause man, do I miss a pen and a paper, a stereo, a taper, me and Eric being a nice big plate of fish, which is my favorite dish, but without no money, it's still a wish. Cause I don't like to dream about getting paid, so I dig into the books of the rhymes that I made. So now it's a test to see if I got pulled. Hit the studio, cause I'm paid in full.
That's a song produced in 1987 called Paid in Full. So what, you know, in terms of dancing, I mean, obviously this is the best part. We want to keep that going over and over again. But what influence is it having on the culture and the music itself?
Well, if we're talking about this song, you know, Rakim, you know, we call in our you know, culture, we call Rakim. Rakim is like the Bob Dylan of hip hop. You know, if you want anybody to understand, he's like the one of the holy grail pieces that we have in hip hop, is because he introduced, you know, his rhyme style, and at the same time he introduced a different religion to hip hop that we didn't even know. You know, a lot of us were Christians, and here comes Islam that we wasn't even, you know, introduced to as kids. But it's funny that this is the song that I broke down to my mother, because my mom started to say, well, son, you know, when I started to make money off this thing, she said, well, son, you know, just explain to me what you do, because I don't know. You know what I mean? You know, I bought you these CDs and I bought you these albums, but I still don't know. So I used this song and the message in this song to break it down to my mother. Like, you know, mom, he says, thinking of a master plan because ain't nothing but sweat inside my hand. Ain't that your story? Ain't that the story of a working class American? Like, you know what I mean? That's how he starts this song. The song is about him talking about, instead of me going out doing something wrong, now I learn to earn because I'm righteous. I feel great. So maybe I might just search for a 9-to-5. If I strive, then maybe I'll stay alive. That's the song of a lot of people, no matter if you like hip hop or not.
That is a clip from our interview with hip hop producer Ninth Wonder, originally aired June 1st. I am here with producer Charlie Sheldon Orman, looking back at some of his favorites. What stood out for you, Charlie?
One quote that Ninth said in that clip really stood out, and he says that sampling has always been a part of American culture, which is so true. I mean, you know, so much of culture, popular culture, references other iterations of culture, you know, just kind of keeping this wheel turning and making it grow simultaneously to create this big thing that we do call popular culture. So hearing him lay that out was really special.
Producer Charlie Sheldon Orman, my guest today, looking back, producer picks for 2016. It will continue on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, and today I'm talking with Charlie Sheldon Orman, one of the fine producers here on the State of Things who make this show possible. They get to look back and tell us what they think are some of their favorite programs from the past year, and a conversation with a hip-hop performer, Rapsody, is on your list as well.
That's correct. So we were just talking about our conversation with hip-hop producer Ninth Wonder, who is actually the producer for Rapsody. So Rapsody is a phenomenal artist. She's just very creative and very, very inspiring. She's also from the area, from Raleigh, but grew up in Snow Hill, North Carolina, you know, Eastern North Carolina. And she has really skyrocketed over the years in a lot of ways. A couple years ago, she was one of the only guest rappers on Kendrick Lamar's seminal album, To Pimp a Butterfly. And then we had her on our show shortly after 9th. We had Rapsody on in early July. The week after we have her on our show, it was a great conversation. The week after she announces that she's been signed with Roc Nation, which is Jay-Z's label.
Just shows you the power of this program.
It does. I think the State of Things bump. Jay-Z was listening. Said, I gotta sign her. So I'm obviously very happy to see her having such great success. It's no surprise because she's such a great artist. And to have her, Ninth Wonder, in close proximity to us is really, really great.
All right, so set up this part of the conversation we're going to hear.
Sure. So at first, we're going to hear a sample of Rapsody's song called The Man, which talks about the experience of black men. And then you come in and talk to her about the process for writing that song. And then she talks about her own identity as a rapper, which is really special. And then we also get a little shout out to Ninth Wonder in there as well.
The Man. Of the house since his dad left. Wake up days feeling stressed. No stability, every year got a new address. Never changed the view from the window, he's seeing mad arrest. He saw his homie's death, same age, same story. Question God, wonder why he would take such a young shorty. It ain't even 8:40, already he thinking poorly. But still, he's the mom trust him now to lock the place down. Feed his younger brother and sister, make sure they both lay down. For she home, can't be on the phone, gotta wake up early next morn. He don't have a lot of fun having to be so grown. At night he pray the world just throw him a bone. Tired and stressed, his grades suffer now. They don't know about home, so his teacher's on his back again. And he don't own phones, kids pick at him. Now he feel he need those to belong. Daydreaming about a life, living just like Puff Combs. On his walk to the crib, he always hears several blown. Trying to think positive, but everything's wrong. Why his daddy can't be at home and beat the motherfucker.
I'm curious to know what kind of feedback you've gotten on a song like that from a rapper who is female. I'm not going to call you a female rapper, but the fact is, you're a female talking about a male experience.
Right. The response has been amazing, and especially from a lot of men and young boys. Like, I get you know, messages and DMs and tweets, and, you know, I'll do a show and a lot of guys will come up and they'll tell me, thank you for doing this song. And then, you know, they'll say, like, it's crazy that it took a woman to do it, but, you know, it's amazing how you captured our story and our feelings in a song as a woman. But, you know, it's a lot of thank you. Like, they feel like, you know, you gave us a voice and you told our story when a lot of people don't understand, and you made it relatable for people. So, you know, the response has been, like, amazing. You know, people tell me they ride and they cry to it, or, you know, so.
Did you have any hesitation in your own mind about making that song?
Oh, no. Yeah. No hesitation. Only because it was honest. And when it's honest, you know, I don't hesitate. Like, if that's what, you know, hip-hop is. It's a voice of the people, and it tells that story. And I felt like it was a story and a topic that wasn't talked about or hasn't been talked about enough in hip-hop. And as a woman, like, I want to tell it, too, from my perspective, to say, like, I understand. You know, I'm not a man, and I don't know how that feels, but I understand, and I want to show you why and that I do understand by making a song about it, and you have my support and my empathy, you know. So that was just how I took it. You know, I had a lot of friends, you know, well, not a lot, but I had enough, you know, that grew up without fathers and had to grow up fast and had to take on a lot more responsibility than I did at their age. And even too, like Lavelle Moton, who's North Carolina Central coach, he wrote a book recently, you know, about growing up without a dad. So, you know, I wrote it for him and his story. And, you know, that's just how it was.
Again, we talked about not wanting, and we can certainly understand why you don't want to be called a female rapper. Every time you kind of give you another silo, nobody wants to be called that. But the fact is, you're a woman in a field where there are very few women in this particular field.
Right.
Is that, does that give you a sense of responsibility? Do you feel that to some weight because of the fact that there aren't many women doing what you're doing?
It's not a bad weight that I look at it as. You know, I'm happy to fill the void. But, you know, when I first got in it, I didn't mind being called a female rapper because I looked at it like that. Like, you know, there's a void. There aren't a lot of us representing, you know, women at the time. You know, there was only one, and that was Nicki. So, you know, it's like I looked at it as like, you know, I'm happy to be a female rapper, you know, to be that representation. But, you know, I look at it as my responsibility. You know, I feel like I have a purpose, and that's it, you know, to bring balance, you know, to hip hop and to show especially young girls that, you know, womanhood comes in many different forms and shapes and sizes and colors and personalities. You know, I'm a tomboy. You know, you don't have to show your body, but if you love your body, that's okay too. You know, I grew up in a time where I had MC Light and Queen Latifah and Salt and Pepper and Little Kim and Foxy Brown and Lauryn Hill. And they all were different. They all had different styles. You know, their dress was all different. And it gave me a choice. You know, it's like, you know, I love Little Kim. I ride to Little Kim. I respect Little Kim. But I'm digging Lauren's style because, you know, that just fits me more. I'm more comfortable like that. And, you know, that's, I feel like that's my responsibility.
As you grow, you certainly have grown in popularity and you have a much wider audience now. And I wonder if that has caused you to any conflict in your own mind about, you know, whether or not fame comes with the price of having to repeat or go in a direction musically that you don't want to do. Have you felt that kind of pressure to move away from your roots to what it was that got you here?
No, I haven't felt that pressure, but that's only because of my circle of people. That's because, you know, I'm under Ninth Wonder and, you know, I have, you know, supporting label mates and the people I choose to surround myself around, they get it. And, you know, they keep me grounded. Growing up in North Carolina, you know, I don't have to walk out of my door and compete with a million rappers. It's not like a big metropolitan like New York or L.A., you know, so it keeps me grounded.
What a treasure it is to have somebody like Ninth in our community, you know, right, who actually understands and is a scholar of the music, a historian who cares about what the music is and can certainly, you know, make it happen.
Right.
So that
right,
when an artist like you with the enormous talent that you have comes along, kind of going to be exposed to that.
Yeah, he's prepared me well, too. Yeah. You know, even for the fame, you know, he's like, you know, this is what comes with fame.
Yeah.
But you can be successful and without being famous and still, you know, have the money and do things that you love. because once you compromise your art or compromise yourself, then you lose some sort of happiness. Mm. And, you know, just his advice, and then seeing it too, like, you know, people that chase the fame kind of lose themselves, and they don't seem to be as happy.
All right, that's a discussion from back in July with hip-hop artist Rapsody, and I'm here now with Charlie Shelton Ormond, a producer who chose that among his top picks in the year 2016. Charlie, I want to ask you, because if you're a producer on The State of Things, you cover a wide variety of topics that you have to research, and we sit down and try to work together to understand what this conversation is going to be about. Without you, I can't do it, and the other producers. But I want to know, you've chosen two hip-hop artists so far, and I wonder if that was you were a big hip-hop fan coming in, or if there's something about the kind of research you do on the show that brought you closer to the music.
Yeah, well, before being a producer on the show, I like listening to hip hop. I've listened to hip hop for several years. But to take it such that extra mile, or just like have that extra access to a certain knowledge in hip hop by bringing on folks like Ninth Wonder and Rapsody to just continue developing this context to the music, I think has been really special for me, you know, as a huge fan of both of their works. But I think obviously special for our listeners, right? I mean, connecting the backstories and the nuances to the music that we're hearing, it's really, sparked a lot of interest for me in hip hop that continues to grow and grow and grow. That had a sort of foundation coming in, to the work of Rapsody and Ninth, but it just grows.
Yeah, just being able to research it and have people who understand the history so well right here in our backyards, what a break. Well, what's next, Charlie?
So next, we're going to kind of continue, you know, we've been talking about some musicians. We're going to continue in the popular culture realm and have a clip from our regular program called Back Channel. Took on a new name this year. It was Culture 360 a year ago when we talked about it. But that name change kind of goes to show how this is a breathing and evolving show in a lot of ways. What we do in the show is the tagline is connecting culture and context. So we're taking these cultural moments in popular culture and putting context and nuance to them, referencing back different things in history, whatever it might be. It's a really great program. I love working with Natalie Bullock Brown and Mark Anthony Neal. And then in this clip that we're about to hear, it's a part of a program where Natalie and Mark and yourself, Frank, are talking about a couple different things. We're looking at the recent movie, The Birth of a Nation. We're looking at the documentary 13th by Ava DuVernay about mass incarceration. And then in this clip specifically, we're going to hear about the show Luke Cage on Netflix. It's about a bulletproof black superhero.
Here we go.
I wanted to ask Mark something, which is, if you remember when Shaft and Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song came out, there was a New York Times critic, a black man, who basically said or posed the question, what will black people find more beneficial? The painful truth of Sweet Sweetback's or the beautiful lie, essentially, of Shaft? And to me, Luke Cage, in some ways, begs that question. What are we talking about? A beautiful lie, a black man who can stop bullets and is bulletproof, or are we talking about something that's a little more nuanced and deeper? Something that we need to unpack.
I think there's clearly a kind of Afrofuturist bent to this, right? I mean, this is kind of an imagining of a black world as it doesn't exist, and some of it's romantic, some of it is aspirational. But you know, even as Luke Cage is bulletproof, and you know, spoiler alert here, you know, at the end of the first season, he ends up back incarcerated again, right? He's back in custody. Mm-hmm. So even with all these powers, right? And again, part of this, you can argue that he has a sense of integrity about who he is and the truthfulness of his experience, right? That, you know, he's willing to take the risk to stand on that, even as it has him going back, you know, to the penitentiary. So I think it's a combination. I think in many ways, what you get is kind of this combination of Superfly and Shaft in that regard.
Mm-hmm. So it's aspirational, but also representational.
Oh,
so
absolutely.
You get all of that in the same thing. But the idea that if you draw the characters well enough, if they're authentic enough, even if they're superheroes, bulletproof black man in it, that doesn't mean they're not realistic in the sense and authentic in the sense that they carry their context with them. that becomes the storyline in some ways. You don't have to beat me over the head with the themes because right. now I'm seeing people driven and having to make choices in a context that may not be familiar to me.
Right, right.
And or maybe terribly familiar to me.
Right. right. And I think, I mean, I appreciate what Mark said because I think that there is something to be said about seeing a black male character who is bulletproof when given everything that is going on around us and many black males who are clearly not bulletproof right. who have been killed by law enforcement. That bulletproofness of Luke Cage becomes an integrity. It becomes a character that, right. and I'm talking about character as in like what's inside of you that I think is definitely representational and different and something that we haven't really seen.
And subtle embedded Absolutely. Cultural references. Here's another clip from the series.
Lemonade. Popular drink.
And it still is.
There we go. Lemonade. I thought it was iced tea. Sorry, I couldn't resist. I'm so sorry. But tell us why lemonade is
so. It's a
here.
Short little reference, and they kind of give you a little hint to it because it's from episode 9, and episode 9 is named Dwick. And Dwick, you know, arguably might be my favorite Gangstar song, but there's a line in Dwick where Guru goes, lemonade is a popular drink, and it still is. Mm-hmm. And again, Jay-Z uses that same line, you know, when he contributes to a remix of All the Way Up, and he makes reference to Beyonce's Lemonade, right? That's the line in which he does it, right? So again, it's like this kind of densely layered thing right. that it, in some ways is just, you know, Chio working in passing, yeah. right? But for folks who are really committed right. to the culture and deep in the culture, they're going, mm-hmm. right, this was something
right,
for
they're
me.
Hearing it.
Right.
Yeah.
There it is, a clip from our regular segment Back Channel with popular culture experts, professors Mark Anthony Neal and Natalie Bullock Brown. Producer Charlie Sheldon Orman produces that for us each month. That one aired in October. Charlie, what's next?
Next, we're going to hear from writer Margot Lee Shetterly, who came on our program recently to talk about her book Hidden Figures, which actually looks at the black women that worked for NASA during the space race. The catchphrase is kind of who helped win the space race. But these women are incredibly inspiring, incredibly powerful stories. They're working as, quote, human computers for NASA. During a time of racial segregation, they're experiencing racial discrimination, you know, both in the workplace and outside of it during this era. And Margot Lee Shetterly has done so much work on this and is so passionate about it. This book is being made into a movie right now. It's going to be released very soon. But Margot Lee Shetterly is so down to earth and just so friendly and passionate about this. She talks about one of the subjects of the book, Katherine Johnson, who helped out on John Glenn's mission. We hear that story, which is really great. And we also hear Margot Lee Shetterly's personal backstory to NASA as well.
So Katherine Johnson's a name that perhaps people have heard, particularly in the last year, because a year ago, President Obama awarded her the Presidential Medal of Freedom for her work at a moment that is the one that's really dramatized in the film that is now being made. Of this story, in which she calculated the orbital equations, the equations that define the orbital mechanics for John Glenn's flight. And so for those of you who don't know, John Glenn, who is now in his 90s, became a national hero because this orbital flight, so a flight that took him outside of the Earth's atmosphere and orbiting around the planet, you know, like satellites, this is, you know, something that we understand now, but this was a big deal back in 1962. His flight was successful, and this was a real moment in which the United States vaulted ahead of the Soviet Union in the space race. Well, back at the Langley Research Center in Hampton, Virginia, an African-American woman was one of the co-authors on the report that laid out the equations for that. And she also then, in the time counting down to that flight, she was asked to double-check the equations. So they've been programmed into the electronic computer, which was a newfangled thing at that time. She had been asked to double check by hand with her calculating machine, her pencil and paper, the output of the electronic computer as part of a pre-flight checklist for his flight.
Well, there's actually a great story about that and about John Glenn's comment. Because remember, he's about to be lodged in a large thimble and sit still while he spins around the Earth. So
yeah,
his
and
job,
on top of a big exploding candle.
On top of a missile.
Candle,
top know, of
on
a missile,
exactly.
So he's a little concerned about his safety and whether or not the math was right. But tell us the story about kind of how the checks and balances worked.
Yeah, so, you know, I mean, this is a really big deal. And we have to remember, you know, we've got electronic computers and our toasters and our cars, everything today. But this was a new thing back then. And, you know, John Glenn, you know, all of these guys obviously concerned about doing everything they could to minimize the possibility of failure at any point along the way in this flight. John Glenn said to the engineers who were responsible for the trajectory analysis, you know, get the girl to do it. What he meant was get the girl, this was Katherine Johnson, check the numbers, make sure the computer output is right, get her to do it by hand. If the girl says the numbers are good, then, you know, I'm ready to go. So it was, you know, one of the many pre-flight checklists for that flight.
It's a great story, one of many in your book. But I think another interesting story is your own personal story, your sense of growing up around all of these women and your sense of normal, that this is what women did. I mean, I'll have you tell it a little bit better. But your perception of women mathematicians because you could see those faces all around you.
Yeah, I was really, in retrospect, extremely fortunate to grow up in, first of all, in a household where I had a black scientist. My father's literally, you know, a research scientist who worked at the NASA Langley Research Center, knew a number of people, you know, who were part of the community, who were African-American or female or both. So, you know, when I went to work to see my father, you know, on, you know, send your kids to work day or whatever, I got a chance to see people who looked like me, whether they were African American, whether they were female, and know that they worked at NASA, which, you know, I mean, you think, wow, they were literally rocket scientists. You know, we use that as shorthand for smart people. And so I was able at a young age to equate being black or being a woman with being a smart person who worked at NASA.
That was writer Margot Lee Shetterly talking about her book, Hidden Figures. Clip originally aired in November, and I am here with producer Charlie Sheldon Orman talking about his favorites for 2016, and that conversation will continue on the state of things in just a moment. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, continuing our series of shows looking back at last year, listening to some of the favorite segments, at least according to our producers. And today's producer is Charlie Sheldon Orman, whose name you usually hear at the end of the show. And now he's here all the way through telling us about his favorites from the past year. What do you have next?
Next, I have a clip from the comedians, the Sklar brothers, two brothers, identical twins, both comedians. They came to the area to film a show for the Travel Channel, and they came on our program to talk to you, talk about their stand-up show that they were doing in Raleigh that weekend, and then also to field questions, callers coming in, calling in to give them suggestions for places to go for their show. But this is
we had a little to do, didn't we?
We had a little to do. This is an example. Let me just say they're funny people. They're very nice.
Good guys.
Good guys. Great guys. And it was a great segment. It was funny. But this is an example of why radio and TV sometimes don't really mix.
I have a long history with TV.
You do?
I've been doing radio news for a long, long time back at NPR. And I'm telling you, photographers, particularly at the network level,
that's right.
They're fine people. They do a good job. But they are nasty.
Yeah.
And they push you out of the way and they do whatever they want and they lie to you. And then I've been pushed out of the way. I've been knocked over. I've been hit.
Absolutely.
So therefore.
In the clip, you say they're trained to get the shot. So what the Sklar brothers wanted to do was they wanted to bring cameras into our studio to get the shot for the Travel Channel. We wouldn't allow it. We wouldn't allow it.
By we, you mean me.
Well, I agreed with you, Frank. But yes, your experience was the driving force. Yeah. And so it had to be, I had to be a couple things that day. A producer, a welcomer at the door. Also a bouncer for cameramen.
Because they were going to push their way in, even though we said no.
We have like a steel-plated door, but they were going to come in anyways. So in this clip, the Sklar brothers talk about their process of going to these different cities and quote, finding the funny in each city. And then they get a little jab at you for not bringing cameras in. You go back and forth. You have some laughs. And then they talk about their visit to Raleigh as well.
There are some places that have just natural, you know, easy things to latch onto. And I think as we start to go to cities, things start to file under certain categories. There's food. There are hidden gems within a city.
There's history. There's entertainment. There are the idiosyncrasies of the city itself. There's the way people speak. All these things, you know, they make up the personality, again, that pie that we're talking about.
It's a composite of the city. And for us, it's almost like we're good friends with Jeff Ross, who is the roast master. He's probably the best living, you know, roasting comedian. And he said something.
Rickles is pretty good.
Yes, he is still alive. But I'm talking about roasting in like the Comedy Central roasts and whatnot. Why are you attacking me?
Because I felt
radio.
Like you needed to get attacked,
Randy.
Confrontation on public radio.
We'll attack Frank for not letting us put cameras in here. No, I'm kidding. Our cameras are outside in the parking lot.
I love the shots
shooting
you're getting.
From across the street.
You're actually in Chapel Hill. These are great shots.
They are great shots. Thank you, Frank. What he said to us, that when you're roasting someone, if you love them, that comes through. Mm-hmm. And
a really high compliment. So you don't want it to be mean.
We don't want to be mean-spirited.
We really understand it.
And so you got to walk that line. It's like if we're outsiders and we just come in and make fun of things, then audiences know that. So we have to really experience it, find what we love about it, and find what
That love has to come through in the jokes.
It's interesting because that's the kind of the Garrison Keillor approach, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, definitely taken off on his region of the country and his folk, but they're his folk. So he's got a little in there.
He
has to do it with love, right? Because if he's just hating his folk, then he's not going to be
Garrison Keillor. I think there is a tremendous amount of no matter how much he complains about certain things, no matter how much he really goes after something,
if you've ever been ribbed about something you know you do, you love it. There's some part of you.
Someone understands you.
Someone gets you on the deepest
level.
Took
the time to care. And
I'm going
to
put out a different call because I know a lot of people are calling for places, and that's what we asked for, but not so many. Well, the places to go, have dinner, but little idiosyncrasies, things that you notice about your own place. You may have been raised here and you find it idiosyncratic. Possibly you're a newcomer and you found it downright weird. One of the wonderful things that I've noticed about this area is just speech pattern. I just love, as I say, Buffalo, New York, and we've got our way. Got a way of expressing ourselves up there, as I'm sure you guys have figured out.
We did. We guys did figure that out.
But there's this double conditional in the southern speech. Not only might you, but you might could.
You might could. You might do it.
That's like hoping with hope. Yeah. You know, that's the waffle on top of the waffle.
That's right.
Lingually speaking, as we are.
Linguistically. I don't know why I'm correcting
you
so much.
Why are you coming off on me?
Because I'm on Frank's side. Why did you want cameras in here, Randy?
Because I wanted cameras to be in the room.
I wouldn't let them bring their cameras.
You wouldn't let us be like, what happened? Did something happen?
What happened to you in your life? I need to know.
I'm in Washington, D.C., work for NPR. I've seen photographers. Here's the thing. They're wonderful people.
Yes.
I would share my bathroom with them.
Sure. I wouldn't go that far, Frank.
And my restaurant. But I will tell you what, professionally, they are trained to get the shot.
Right.
And if you get to that level where you're actually working for the Travel Channel.
Did something happen to you, though?
Many times.
What happened?
They push you out of the way. They pull your plugs out.
You were physically abused by a cameraman.
Knocked to the ground more than once.
What?
More than once.
I'm so sorry.
I would share my bathroom with that man and woman who did that. The problem is they're professionally trained to get the shot.
I understand.
They would pull the mics out of the way. They would dance on this table. They would sit on my head.
I don't want them to sit on your head.
Because they're good. And that's why I couldn't let them in.
He understands.
I wanted the explanation. We didn't want to dig so far into your past, but I wanted to find out what was
going on. And then there was a thing with my mother.
Let him get out the thing with his mom. She filmed him from age 2 to age 7, it felt very intrusive.
It was the sonogram.
You were part of the original 7. Oh, yeah. They were still doing ultrasounds when he was out of the womb.
I think it's just very intrusive.
All right.
So what have you found so far about Raleigh? What's cool about this place?
First of all, we love this notion that the food can kill you. We also love that there is this struggle between old and new. There's a Confederate statue in the middle of downtown, and that of a Confederate soldier. I know that rubs people the wrong way.
Some people might say it's fine. It's part of our past.
Other people might say get rid of it.
There's a debate. There is like a legitimate debate, and you can see all sides of it.
We say don't get rid of the statue.
Keep the statue.
We say build another statue connected to that statue. And that statue should be of Michael Jordan dunking on the Confederate soldier. Now, stay with me.
What's wrong with that? Who isn't going to love that?
That solves everything.
That's a clip from our conversation with the comedians Randy and Jason Sklar. Back in February, Charlie Shelton Norman produced the segment and kept the photogs from getting in.
I did.
Kept their battering rams at bay.
I watched the episode that they did. It was a good episode. We weren't featured in it,
though. They kept us out. Yeah. They're great guys. They were fun to work with.
I'm a fan of theirs.
Okay, so what's next?
Next is a meet that we did. So normally with Meets, we spend the hour with one person. But back in May, we brought on a couple members of the Durham Bulls. We did a meet with the Durham Bulls. So we had two players on and one of their coaches. So we had Luke Maley and Mark Sappington, two players, and the hitting coach, Ozzy Timmons. And this was just a fun conversation. We got the inside scoop on minor league baseball in a lot of ways. And the clip that we're going to hear is starting out with Mark Sappington talking about a time that he got traded in the middle of a baseball game. Mark Sappington is a character. He was so much fun to have on the show. And this yielded my favorite catchphrase of the whole year: you're out like a Brussels sprout.
So I got traded. It was November 5th, which is my mom's birthday. Happy birthday, Mom, back then. Man, and happy Mother's Day. I love you a ton. So we were we're in the middle of the game. I go in, and I throw the eighth inning. And, you know, this is November, so we've been playing since spring training in February, and I'm just, like, I'm pretty gassed. And so I go out there. I throw, you know, I don't throw particularly well, but I get a good result. And I remember coming out onto the bench, and they're like, hey, you're done. And so I was sitting there, and I was just laughing with some of the guys. I was like, man, I'm glad I'm not going out there for another inning, because I did not feel good. And then we're all just laughing, you know. I mean, healthy. I was healthy, but it was just like, whoa. So my then.
Did you really do that on the bench? Because I've never seen a pitcher do that.
I guarantee you did. Okay. I guarantee it.
Tell you what, this is life is good, baby. So I get my pitching coach at the time, Matt Wise. He walks over to me with a phone, and I was like, oh my goodness. You know, Halloween was 6 days prior. I didn't act out or do anything too wild. So, you know, I was just like, you know, I don't think I've done anything that would merit a phone call from someone telling me that I'm in trouble. So I said, okay. I get the phone, and it's Bobby Scales, who is our head of player development. Ozzy, you probably know Bobby because he played with the Cubs, right?
Yep.
He's like, Sap, this is Bobby. He's like, congratulations, you've just been traded to the Tampa Bay Rays. And I was like, I froze for a second. I'm in like the hall. We're in Mesa, or we're like basically Tempe, Arizona. And it was like someone getting in a car crash. You know, they tell you like everything, your life flashed before your eyes. Like my baseball career flashed before my eyes as far as like with the Angels, because that was the only team I knew. It's kind of like, you know, it's like your first girlfriend, you know. It's like, man, I think I'm going to marry this girl, you know. And it's like, oh, well, hey, guess what? we're trading you for somebody who looks better than you, bud.
Your girlfriend's dad just called, and you're moving to Tampa.
Yeah, you're out like a Brussels sprout. So it moved me right on. And but it was awesome. And
well, how bad? I mean, seriously, on a trade, I mean, I assume that means that they felt like they could do without you. I mean, to some extent, but also it doesn't necessarily mean, is that what that means always, or does that mean no, wait, you're good and we can get something for you,
right?
We need something that you're, you know, we have plenty of pitchers, and I guess you never have plenty.
It's like somebody wants you, you know. And so the Rays wanted me, so that's obviously very you know, it's a beautiful thing. It's always great to be wanted. But at the moment, you know, in that moment, it was like, man, like they just shipped me off, you know?
Yeah, because, like, to, like, the garden shop at Home Depot, then you'd think, oh, gee, I really lost something.
You know, I'm a Petunia fan, so well, that's yeah.
The thing about that is, though, like, I mean, not to cut you off, but the...
No, go ahead.
The thing about fans that everybody's always talking about... Thanks, I will. Everybody's always talking about, you know, on blogs or, you know, let's take the Reds, where I grew up. Everybody's always saying, well, you know, they should trade this guy for this guy and trade this guy. And so you kind of become the idea of a player having an actual life gets lost. Mm-hmm. So what Sapp's talking about, I've never been traded, but I can tell you if I ever did, I mean, that would devastate me. I mean, I'd be excited and I'd move on, but not devastate you to the point where you don't feel wanted, but it devastates you because it turns your life upside down. You know, I mean, you're moving different cities. You're trying to plan when your family's coming out next. Now all of a sudden, you know, you're doing a complete 180, and you're at the mercy of what this team does with you. So that's one thing fans, I think, get lost when they talk about they should trade this guy. I mean, there's a lot that goes into it.
That's a clip from our conversation with members of the Durham Bulls baseball team. We did that in May. Charlie Sheldon Orman produced that segment. What'd you like about that?
You're Out Like a Brussels Sprout.
That's
Frank.
Cool.
It was
That's
great.
Cool.
It was great. Well, Mark Sabatin was great. Ozzie Timmons, the hitting coach, also to get that perspective of a veteran in the industry. But also Luke Maley, which we heard as well in that clip, just talking about, you know, sort of this behind the scenes that you don't see. You go to the Durham Bulls games and, you know, you're just cheering until the fireworks come on. But, you know, you don't hear about these behind the scenes. What happens to these guys who are in this transitional period for so long in minor league baseball? So getting that insight was great.
I have to say, doing the show was fun, too, because you don't get to see them that intimately. And as you say, Mark Sabatin, bit of a character. It comes through.
Yeah.
And watching the players react to him, the other players react, it's very clear that in the clubhouse, they're rolling their eyes the same way as they were here. So it's kind of fun to be behind the scenes. You've got some music for us next. What's next?
I do. So next I'm going to play a song from folk singer Joan Shelley. She's from Louisville. She came to the area in September to play hopscotch. And just to set up this song, so let me just say we're coming to an end to 2016. It's been a year. It's been a year for some folks. It's been an exhausting year. We've gone through a lot in every which way. But I really love this song because it's very soothing. It's very therapeutic in a lot of ways. And Joan Shelley has a very serene and incredible voice. She's a good songwriter. Just the lyrics to the song really speak to me, and I hope they speak to other folks. The song is called Easy Now. Some of the lyrics to it, easy now, it's almost over. The fever will run out now that the nights are colder. Who will lift your face to see how the stars shine brighter when you're lonely? It's a beautiful song. It's been comforting, and I hope others enjoy it as well.
Joan Shelley, the song Easy Now.
Easy now, it's almost over. The fever will run out now the nights are colder. Who will lift your face to see how the stars shine brighter when you're lonely? The rains came down, ran across the river. Sweet the sound, and the sand familiar. You pulled the clothes from the line and came in. You were needed at my side. In the open, my heart beats loudly. But we're not broken, no, we just are free again. Again. Easy now, it's almost over. To the friends who stuck around, go and hold them closer. The ones who watched you wander out on the rocks when the light of day was fading. In the open, our hearts beat loud. We're not broken, no, we just are free again, again. Easy now.
Joan Shelley performing the song Easy Now, one of Charlie Sheldon Orman's favorites for the year. Charlie, it has been such a pleasure working with you. Thank you so much for all your hard work this year.
Thank you, Frank. I appreciate it.
We're going to go out with Joan Shelley's music, but first I want to thank Charlie and the rest of our production staff, Laura Lee, Anita Rao, Katie Barron, and Laura Pelliser, Robin Copley, our technical director, Al Wadarski helping out, Brent Wolf, WUNC's news director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio. Once again, Joan Shelley.
Stay on my shore and don't desert me. And if you go, the wind will blow you back to me. And if your boat is broken out on the rocks, it was an anger but a longing. We feed the birds syrup and seeds.